Let me say that again for the record. So now that the mic's on, I want to call this special board meeting to order. Roll call.
Hooper?
Here.
Forsythe?
Here.
Lightfoot?
Here.
LaPierre? Leader? Denisha?
Here.
Perkins?
Here.
Akers?
Here.
Fay?
Here.
Timmerman? Colbert? Burke? Arquette?
Here.
Paquin?
Here.
Bell?
Here.
Okay. Next up is approval of the agenda. Motion for approval of the agenda, please. Mr. Denisha, seconded by Mr. Lightfoot. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Okay. Presentation of the resolutions, Mr. Denisha.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to offer a resolution authorizing the chair to sign an agreement between the New York Environmental Protection Spill Compensation Fund and County of St. Lawrence, New York, regarding certain tax delinquent properties, and move for its adoption.
Is there a second? Seconded by Mr. Perkins. Mr. Paquin wishes to be a co-sponsor on this resolution. Okay. No objections. Steve, you going to speak to it?
Thank you. I think this board is more than aware of the efforts that have been undertaken by the treasurer's office, by the county attorney's office, by the real property office, and by our outside environmental counsel, Gary Bowich, to target specific properties for potential remediation and return to productive use. Since 2013, the county has targeted about 20 of these types of environmentally contaminated properties and sought agreements with the New York State Office of the Comptroller, who operates the Spill Compensation Fund. The resolution you have in front of you actually addresses five distinct properties. Two of them are the Weaver sites in DeKalb, and three of them are identified as the Slavin site, the Gardner site, and the Cornell site. I know this board has had a great deal of discussion about several of these properties, specifically the Cornell site. The combined back taxes on all five of these lots is more than $1 million in taxes that have gone unpaid. But because we could not move forward with foreclosure without potentially endangering the county and getting into the chain of liability, they sat and continued to accrue those back taxes. With this potential agreement, the spill fund will be able to come in with the help of the DEC, clean up the sites, and the county will be able to move forward to foreclosure and put those sites back into productive use. These are all commercial sites, commercially zoned sites, so that they can be used. And three of these locations, the Slavin, Gardner, and Cornell site, dovetail well with what the village of Messina has been hoping to do in redeveloping the downtown area. In fact, right now they're working quite hard on the main Slavin's property. The 31 Water Street is a secondary Slavin's property. Also, in this resolution, you'll note that there were a couple of other properties that we had targeted. We have already performed phase ones on those properties where they have done a historical review. And from that historical review, Mr. Bowich was able to speak to the oil spill fund and get them delisted on the spill fund's numbers. So those properties also will now move forward. So we're pretty excited. This is the largest batch that we've had go in one foul swoop, and they should be moving forward fairly quickly with remediation.
Any comments? Mr. Denisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank our county attorney. This is huge. You know, obviously, as you say, the back taxes are $1 million, and you know, these properties have been sitting there, delinquent in taxes. The county has been making the towns or villages whole, and you know, the owners, you know, there was absolutely no incentive to pay their taxes because the county didn't want. We don't want to take, you know, contaminated property, which makes sense. But I think this is going to be great. It's going to get the property back on the tax rolls, and going to go a long way toward cleaning up certain communities.
Anyone else? I too, Steve, want to commend you for your actions. These eyesores amongst the community, everybody's got them in all the towns, and they're just sitting there. Trees and weeds are growing up, and so we'll be able to get these back into productivity and back on the tax roll. And Gary Bulwich, your partner in this effort, has been excellent, and so I want to commend him also. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Arquette.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank our county attorney for all his hard work on this project as well. And as you had mentioned earlier, the leadership in both the town and village of Messina have been working hard to revitalize. And this is a tremendous contribution from the county in that effort. So thanks very much to all involved.
Thank you, Tony. Anyone else? Seeing no more discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Okay, we are adjourned from the special meeting.
July 16, 2018, 5:30 p.m. First item is the approval of the agenda. Mr. Forsyth, second by Mr. Timmerman, Mr. Fay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? It's carried. I'll need a motion for approval of the minutes of the June 11th meeting. Mr. Timmerman, seconded by Mr. Arquette, Mrs. Bell. In discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? It's carried. We'll start resolutions tonight with the Planning Department. We have a resolution authorizing the county to submit a Clean Energy Communities grant application for energy efficiency projects in county buildings. Mr. Forsyth, seconded by Mr. Denisha and Mrs. Bell. Jason.
Thank you. Just maybe a quick history here. This is an initiative that's been going on for a couple of years now, since 2016. It was brought forward that a program through NYSERDA, the Clean Energy Communities Program, might be something that the county could benefit from. So for the last couple years, staff have been working to make the county eligible for funding through the Clean Energy Communities Program. There are 10 action items that NYSERDA has identified that would be beneficial to communities to undertake. You had to complete 4 of those action items to be eligible for funding. The way the funding stream works, it's a sliding scale dependent on population. So because of our population, the county's population, we're eligible for the maximum amount of funding, which is $250,000. So we thought that was certainly something to strive for. The 4 action items included a benchmarking policy that was passed back in January of 2017, and then revised because of a correction that needed to be made in April of this year. The second action item was a clean energy upgrade initiative, which is something that the county had really already undertaken through their energy performance contract. So they were able to show that there was a significant savings in energy usage in the county. So that was another check that could be made. The third was a clean fleets initiative, and that was made official through the acquisition of a plug-in hybrid vehicle that's being used by the county highway department, as well as a charging station to go with that. So that was another one that was checked off. And the last one was actually the first one that was undertaken, which was it's called a Solarize initiative. It's basically a marketing campaign to encourage residents, small businesses to install photovoltaic or solar panels on their properties to reduce energy costs. That was all completed over the last 2 years or so. On the 18th of May, we got our official notification that the county had been designated as a clean energy community.
So now the next step is actually applying for the funds that go along with that. There's a 90-day window in which to do that. The application needs to be in by the 18th of August, so we bring this resolution for you tonight to consider and then look for approval at the August meeting to meet that 18th of August deadline. With the funds, we've been working with the Buildings and Grounds Department to see what would be the best use of funding, what would be the most beneficial to the county, as well as meeting the requirements of energy conservation. So there's a good portion of it will be used towards upgrades in the parking lots around the county campus here out at HSC as well, to replace the existing lights with LED lighting. That should reduce going out will reduce the energy usage, energy draw from those lights, and save the county money and be more energy efficient. The remainder of the funding will be used for a variety of heating and cooling upgrades in this building, at the Harold B. Smith Building, the Social Services Building, as well as the Public Safety Complex across the street and the HSC Building out on 310. And happy to answer any questions if there are any on the project.
No questions? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carried. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
And we're going to move on to emergency services. We have a resolution for authorization to fill a dispatcher position in the Office of Emergency Services. Mr. Perkins, seconded by Mrs. Bell.
Good evening. We have two full-time positions available right now. We had two dispatchers that have transferred to other county jobs effective last week. So that left us with two positions that are open, and with the high volume of vacation times and such right now, we're struggling to get things covered. In the long run, we would still be needing the coverage to be able to man the desks over at the 911 center.
Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? It's carried. And we have a second resolution also for authorization to fill a dispatcher position in the Office of Emergency Services. Mr. Arquette, and seconded by Mr. Perkins.
And the same, I sort of bunched them together at the beginning. It's one of the two positions that, as I say, was vacated last week by a transfer within the county.
Questions? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That's carried. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
We're going to move on to the county clerk. We have a resolution for authorization to abolish a part-time motor vehicle clerk position and create and fill a full-time motor vehicle clerk position in the Department of Motor Vehicles. Mr. Forsyth, seconded by Mr. Lightfoot.
Hi. DMV continues to increase at DMV. So far for the year, as of the end of June, we're up 52,363 over 2017. The offices, the local offices also are extremely busy with people coming in to upgrade to enhanced or real ID licenses, so it's getting very difficult to work at the downstate work, so we really could use the full-time position.
Questions for Mary Lou? Mr. LaPierre.
Mary Lou, after meeting that, you had down the bank, there's going to be a net cost, but since this is a recommended chair position, I have to move straight to that.
Oh. Okay. Thank you. Okay, thank you. Yes, we are too. That was a lot of work in the making. They really needed it.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That's carried. Thank you, Mary Lou.
Thank you.
We're going to move on to the sheriff. First, we have a resolution for authorization to fill a correctional officer position in the Sheriff's Office Correctional Division. Mr. Arquette and Mr. Denisha.
You have two listed for Joel and for Lisa. There was an additional correction officer resignation received based on discipline, so I allowed this to be added for consideration this evening, just so that you're aware. So let's go ahead and speak to the first one.
Yeah, we have two openings at the correctional facility. Obviously, there's minimum mandated staffing through New York State. This will maintain that level, the correctional facility.
Questions? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That's carried. And the second resolution, again, is authorization to fill a correctional officer position in the Sheriff's Office Correctional Division. You probably don't have anything to add, right?
Ditto.
Okay. Questions? Mr. Arquette?
No, we need a motion. A second. Oh.
Mr. Arquette has the motion. Mr. Perkins, Mr. Denisha, Mr. Paquin. Nothing to add. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? It's carried. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next resolution is from probation. This is for authorization to fill a fiscal officer position in the probation department. Mr. Forsythe, seconded by Mr. Fay.
My fiscal officer walked in my office last Monday, a week ago, and dropped the bomb that she was leaving. Couldn't have happened at a worse time with budget starting and raise the age budget that is due. So I've asked for an immediate fill on this. With raise the age coming, I'm definitely going to need somebody to help me with all the numbers and figures and to how to figure out how to get the most reimbursement we can get from the state for all the initiatives with that. This position is in charge of a lot of things, all of our quarterly reports, all of our state grants, our block grant, all the restitution surcharges, supervision fees, drug testing fees. I'm lost without it, so I'm asking for an immediate fill, and I would appreciate it.
Questions for Tim? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That's carried.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Is there any old business to come before the committee? Any new business to come before the committee? Okay. And I'm assuming we're going to hold the county administrator's report in the executive session for the next meeting. Okay. We are adjourned.
I'd like to call the Services Committee meeting to order on Monday, July 16th at, we'll say, 5:44 p.m. We need approval of the minutes from June 11th. Motion for that. Mr. Perkins, second by what? Oh, approve the agenda, sorry. So I need a motion to approve the agenda first. Mr. Akers and Mr. Lightfoot. All right, now motion for the approval of the minutes. Oh, Mr. Lightfoot. I'm trying to vote. Did we do approval of the minutes? Motion and second and voted and we're all done? Okay. Now, I was trying to move fast. The first item on the agenda is a presentation from the Behavioral Healthcare Collaborative. Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Should I introduce them?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Ready?
Citizen Advocates was awarded $1.725 million to develop a behavioral health care collaborative, which is a network of community providers, in order to consolidate and work together and eventually contract with the managed care organizations. So I asked Barry Brogan, who's the executive director of the North Country Management Services, and Robert Crawley, senior director of information management, who are both contracting with Citizen Advocates, the lead agency, to develop, you know, a business plan in this project as the Behavioral Health Care Collaborative moves forward. So they've got some information they want to share. They can speak to it much better than I can, so.
Good evening. I'm going to sit right down here. My name is Barry Brogan. I'm the Executive Director of the North Country Behavioral Healthcare Network and its affiliate, the North Country Management Services, LLC. So I want to quickly introduce North Country Behavioral Healthcare Network and what our relationship is with Citizen Advocates, which is the lead agency, which received, on behalf of 15 providers in seven counties, the $1.725 million award to set up some sort of a network of providers. But let me quickly start with our relationship. So the North Country Behavioral Healthcare Network is one of 35 rural health networks spread out throughout the state. You all are familiar with the St. Lawrence Health Initiative. That's one of the 35 rural health networks, as is North Country Behavioral Healthcare Network. We have 19 members in seven counties, many of which are part of the project that we're going to discuss in just a moment, but there are others as well. Here in St. Lawrence County, the North Country Freedom Home, the Messina Independent Living Center, TLS, Transitional Living Services that comes up from Jefferson County, and Rose Hill are all members of North Country Behavioral Healthcare Network. We were founded in 1997, and we are a project management organization. We write grants, we manage grants, and our mission is to advance the access and quality of behavioral health. And now, with the very significant changes within the healthcare environment, to also facilitate our members' readiness for clinical integration with primary care, hospitals and doctors, and other community-based organizations. The BHCC project, it was one that we were very involved in putting together, the 15 members. Ultimately, Citizen Advocates stepped forward to be the lead agency, and then we were contracted with them to do project management services. So that's our relationship. Bob Cawley is my colleague, and he's right behind me. Yes, he is. And we have a brief presentation. We want to make sure that we leave plenty of time for questions. This is a complicated, big lift for behavioral health providers. Hospitals and doctors have been doing this for about 10 years, moving in this direction. This is really the very first time that behavioral health has received any kind of significant resources to move us towards clinical integration. So with that, I'll introduce Bob Cawley, our Director of Information Management.
Thank you, Barry. Can everybody hear me okay?
And I'm going to see how we do this.
Okay.
Let me just make sure that's going to work.
So okay. A couple things before I start is, number one, I'm coming in with an assumption that some of the more vagaries of the healthcare system and the healthcare payment system, that many of you may not be that familiar with that. If you need to disabuse me of that assumption, feel free to do so. But until then, I'm going to get into some fairly basic information. The other thing is, I do tend to use a lot of acronyms. I will do my best to spell those acronyms out. But again, if I fail to do that, please throw something at me and I'll catch on and get it done for you. So we're going to start out with covering a little bit of the reason why all of this is happening. And by all of this, I mean a shift to what's referred to as a value-based payment system. To start that, we're going to talk about the way things are today. And the way things are today is a system called fee-for-service. And basically, it's a fairly simple, you know, at a 30,000-foot level, but as you get down to the ground, it gets fairly complicated. But basically, providers provide services to their patients. Each one of those services is well-defined, has a code and a rate associated with it. So when they provide those services, they have a fee that's assigned to that service. Then they go ahead and bill the insurer. in the cases or the BHCC agencies, most of the time we're talking about Medicaid or a managed care company for Medicaid, such as Fidelis or United Healthcare. That insurer, be it Medicaid, Fidelis, United Healthcare, or some other organization, pays that claim, and then the agency receives the fee for those services, and it goes on from there. Cycle starts over. The key things about that are, number one, it incentivizes volume. So the more services I generate, the more I get paid. It doesn't really do anything to try and address quality, and it doesn't really do anything to try and address collaboration so that you have providers working together on the behalf of the patient. So recognizing those, that has a lot to do with the fact that in this country our healthcare costs are so high, as I'm sure everybody's familiar with that, and in terms of quality, compared to other industrial nations, we're middle of the pack. So trying to rectify those situations, the Medicare and Medicaid and the commercial payers started trying to move to different systems. Medicaid in particular introduced managed care. And so what that does is the DOH then contracts, instead of directly with a provider, they contract with an insurance company such as Fidelis, United Healthcare, and they give that insurance company, that managed care company, a budget and say, this is what we're going to pay you, but we want you to manage this cost the best you can. And the MCO then has put in these processes, such as prior authorization, utilization management, so forth, to try and control utilization by the patients and by the providers. So that's the way they keep costs down for that. The providers are providing the service, but now they're getting paid indirectly from the state through these managed care organizations. Does that all make sense so far?
So if I could just add, this assumption is the old HMO model, crash and burn.
Correct.
Because the state put a cap on how much managed care organizations can make, but didn't put any incentive or requirements about quality oversight and access. So they became gatekeepers, the prior authorization.
Yes, we're ready to go.
Okay.
So
this is the big slide.
Yes. Except for it's there we go. Okay. So this is value-based payment. And so again, if you remember the problems that we had with the fee-for-service system that have not been completely solved by the managed care system, you're incentivizing volume, you are not really incentivizing value, and you're not incentivizing collaboration. So the movement has been to what's referred to as value-based payment, or VBP, and there are a number of different levels, and we'll get into more detail on that in the next slide, but actually this one has the two levels that are most important to the BHCC program. And so these are value-based payment level 1 and 2. Value-based payment level 1, essentially, providers, when they are contracting with an insurance company, they are given, there's a budget for that patient, for that population that they're contracting with. And if they're able to deliver services for less than that budgeted amount, then they have the opportunity to keep a percentage, a portion of that savings. So this is generally referred to as shared savings. And so the other feature of this, though, as Barry mentioned, is the quality metrics. And so typically what will happen is the insurance company and the provider will contract to have either a gateway where, based on their satisfactory performance on those measures, they get access to the full amount of their savings, or they have a percentage based on how well they perform. So it may kind of prorate the savings that they have available to them. So this is called an upside-only model because the provider is not at risk to lose any money, but the provider can share some of those savings. They still get paid their fee-for-service amount, but these shared savings are over and above that fee-for-service.
What if I come in way over cost?
In value-based payment level one, there is no penalty to the provider. The insurance company essentially eats that loss. Okay? So value-based payment level two is very similar, the only difference being now the provider is at risk for some of the loss. And typically what happens then is that the amount of shared savings that they're eligible for will be increased as a payoff basically for taking on some of that risk. So some of the risk for anything over that budget now has shifted from the payer to the provider. And so that's level two. And that is also referred to as upside downside. Okay? So if we get the next slide. As I mentioned, those aren't the only two levels of value-based payment. Level zero is fee-for-service, but then typically you'll have a pay-for-performance program or something like that, where the payer is saying, okay, I have specific metrics. I'll give you a certain dollar amount for achieving each one of these metrics. So fee-for-service, you get some quality in there, but there's not really any kind of cost control. Level one and level two we just talked about. Level one is the fee-for-service shared savings upside only. So no risk for the provider to lose money, but an opportunity to share savings. Level two, fee-for-service with upside and downside, providers taking on some risk, but they are also getting a larger share of any savings. This, most people think, is ultimately going to lead to what's called global capitation. And so in this scenario, the provider is no longer contracting on a fee-for-service basis at all with the payers. They're contracting on a budgeted amount per patient or per patient population, and they're completely at risk now for anything over that budget, and they get the complete amount of savings for anything under that budget. This is probably still a little ways off, but most people think this is the direction that this is going to wind up going. All that makes sense so far? Great. So when it comes to the BHCC and ultimately, in terms of the BHCC, what options do they have to contract under the program? And so one option would be with managed care, Medicaid managed care, Fidelis, United Health, so forth. And so they would contract directly with those organizations for the behavioral health component of the patient's care. Fidelis in particular, who is the organization that is executing the BHCC program for the state, has declared that they will not contract on less than a total cost of care basis. In other words, they don't want to segment the way they contract out by behavioral health, physical health, and so forth. They want an organization that's going to take account for the full range of services delivered to their patients. So that option is kind of foreclosed for the North Country Behavioral Healthcare Collaborative because that is essentially a behavioral healthcare IPA. MVP United, some of the others have not made any such declaration yet. But since Fidelis, for most of our agencies, is the largest payer, that means we need to look at option number two. And option number two is subcontracting essentially with an organization that is going to be accountable for the full spectrum of care. For all intents and purposes in this region, that's the Adirondacks ACO. So the executive committee of the North Country BHCC actually is already starting having some discussions with the Adirondacks. But there are other opportunities available to the IPA to broaden its scope of services, to broaden its scale, and that is by contracting with other IPAs or other provider groups. So there's been some discussion about contracting with primary care providers to be part of the North Country IPA. That would, again, broaden the scope of services provided by the IPA.
Bob?
Yes?
Can you take a step back and talk about the Behavioral Healthcare Collaborative, BHCC, and this thing you're calling an IPA? What is an IPA?
Okay.
What's the relationship?
So an IPA is an independent provider association or independent practice association. And that is a organization of different providers coming together essentially to share resources, contracting, all that kind of thing, governance. One of the options available to the BHCC is to form an independent practice association. And so that would give them the ability not just to contract with the managed care organizations, but also with other organizations such as the ACO or other commercial payers. The plan for the North Country BHCC is to form an IPA. There's a agreement being circulated now that we'll review with each of the agencies in more detail on Wednesday at the steering committee. The plan for this is that essentially the IPA will act as the decision-making body for the BHCC. The board of the IPA will be elected from the steering committee, will be representatives of the steering committee of the BHCC. And so essentially it'll be acting as one, even though we still have to maintain the BHCC and the IPA. Does that make sense? So, the BHCC is a program that the state has put together to try and encourage this collaboration by behavioral health, mental health, substance abuse, and social welfare agencies, because they recognize that these services were lagging behind primary care, hospital, in terms of walking in and towards value-based payment. So there's an opportunity for each one of these agencies to join the BHCC and then the IPA ultimately. But the question is why? The main answer to that is it is our belief that going forward, fee-for-service will not be an option anymore. This will take a few years to play out, but at some point, the payers have indicated fairly strongly that they're going to want to contract completely on a value basis. The state has said that very clearly. Medicare has said that very clearly. And so to be able to contract on a value basis means that you need a much larger scale. You need more resources to be able to support the analytic, data collection, care management, and other activities that are incumbent upon an organization to be able to contract on a value basis. So the answer to the question is why is it's really the best alternative to be able to survive in this environment that is going to be unfolding over the next few years. Anything to add to that, Bear? So, in the North Country Behavioral Health Care Collaborative, there are two tiers of providers, agencies participating. One is a Tier 1, and so that is Article 31 and 32 and home and community-based services. They need to be bill Medicaid for their services or an MCO. The Tier 1 providers will each have a board, a representative on the board. So each agency, one-to-one, has one board member. And they will have dues to pay. The plan right now is $15,000 a year for the Tier 1 providers. As I mentioned before, there's a membership agreement that has been created that has had an initial review by each of the agencies, and we'll have a final review at the steering committee meeting on Wednesday. Go ahead. So then Tier 2 providers would be the smaller providers, some of the agencies that are not 3132 or home and community-based services that are not necessarily billing Medicaid directly. Their participation on the board is going to be collective. So for if there are, say, five Tier 2 agencies, they will select one representative to represent them at the board. So those five, instead of being a one-to-one, it would be a 5-to-1. They'll have one seat on the board. Their dues are also lower. It will be based on their operating revenues for behavioral health and substance abuse services, and expected to be about $2,000 to $5,000 annually. One of the key things about this whole BACC program is that, and this, as we've seen to some extent, is going to be potentially more of a challenge for the counties than for some of the other organizations, is that some of these decisions really have to be made fairly quickly. And we understand that you have a more deliberative process and respect that, but just want to make sure that we're clear up front that we have less than 2 years left on this program now. And making the changes to programs and so forth to be able to succeed in this, sometimes it's going to take some pretty quick decision making.
Can I add?
Yes, you may.
Just a couple other items that the development of this IPA. The membership agreement, which is being served.
Membership. So this is a little bit more about the development of the IPA. The membership agreement is really the preliminary document that will morph into our major governance documents of the IPA. So bylaws, our filing, corporate filings with the state, with the Division of Financial Services, which is the old insurance oversight, as well as Department of Health and other agencies that have to review the IPA. The IPA will be set up as a 501c3 not-for-profit. So it will not be an LLC. It'll be a not-for-profit corporation. Our anticipated, and we'll know more about this after our meeting with the steering committee on Wednesday, but our anticipated scheduling for execution by each member of the membership agreement is we are committed to have a finalized document from the attorneys by no later than August 1st, and we are looking to have those all back signed by September 28th. So we're giving, you know, 2 full months for organizations to get this in front of their attorneys and to get it in front of their boards. And at that point, the signature on that document will declare level one or level two or tier one or tier two membership. So whether the organization is going to come in at the higher governance, higher dues, higher involvement, higher engagement level, or come in at the tier two level, which is a much lower dues and a lesser commitment with regards to engagement. As of right now, we did a straw poll back in May, or end of April, beginning of May. At that point in the game, this document was built off the results of that. We had five of our very small agencies, like our mental health associations and other community-based organizations, came in at the Tier 2 level, and all of our Article 31 and 32s, including three counties, including St. Lawrence County, declared preliminarily no commitment, but preliminary declared that they were interested in level one.
And we were, as the executive committee and the staff, we were extremely excited about that level because we recognize the very important role that the public providers play in their communities. So we have Essex, Clinton, and St. Lawrence counties all provide direct services, and we think that this is the best way to ensure continued public sponsorship of behavioral health services.
All right, next slide. So, just real quickly, just to give you an idea, here's the general area covered by the agencies in the North Central agency. As Jay mentioned earlier, the award for this BHCC was $1.725 million. Citizen Advocate is the lead agency, but there are 15 agencies. I did the math wrong. There's 9, 5, and 1. So St. Lawrence, Franklin, Clinton, Essex, Hamilton, Warren, Washington counties. And, you know, we kind of touched on this a little bit, but basically one of the purposes for creating the BHCC is to have this diverse set of services all brought together so that one organization can coordinate and really push that collaboration forward so that we're making sure that there are many of these Medicaid clients that are touching many agencies, but right now there's a very limited amount of coordination and collaboration among those agencies. This will give us the opportunity to make sure that the right services are getting to the right patients at the right time, the right clients at the right time, with as little duplication as possible, without having gaps in care between the agencies. So these are the 15 agencies that are part of the BHCC. Most of those ones up at the top wound up being in the tier one, according to the straw poll, and the ones down at the bottom, but for the most part, the tier two. So, again, I talked about this briefly, but the board is made up of tier one and tier two. Each tier one agency will have one board member. The tier two collectively will have one. And then this is the committee structure that has been identified. Once the IPA is formed, so the Executive Committee, Data Analytics Committee, Quality Oversight, Governance, Clinical Integration, and Finance and Contracting. And then currently under the BHCC, the Steering Committee appointed 5 of the agencies to act as an Executive Committee. So that's Mark Lukens, who's the Chair from Behavioral Services North, Jane Button from Citizen Advocates, the lead agency, Bob Ross from St. Joseph's Treatment and Recovery Centers, Andrea Deep from the Mental Health Association of Warren, Washington County, and Angela Doe from United Helpers. And then to try and facilitate all this, there are a number of consultants that have been brought in. North Country Management Services, Barry and I, are essentially supporting the committees, doing project management. And the Bonadio Group is the lead consultant. The Rivkin Radler is the law firm that's been working on the documents. Health Management Associates is responsible for quality and clinical integration. And CCSI is responsible for data. I think that's it, correct?
That's it.
Questions?
How is the selection of the executive committee determined?
It was, this was a little before Bob was on the project. It was proposed at a steering committee meeting. Steering committee is all 15 agencies. It was proposed there. It was endorsed by the steering committee, through the whole motion, second discussion, and then a vote. And so this was the committee that was adopted.
Okay, follow up.
Who determines quality?
Go ahead, Bob.
So that's actually the quality committee, once it's formed, will have primary responsibility for that. It is, we have been working with the executive committee and presented to the steering committee a set of metrics to help define quality. Those are based on work that's already been done through various other state programs. The district program had several of these. They're also things that are, for the most part, available through the PSYCHES system, so that we have access to data to be able to start reporting those. Yes, sir.
So just a quick follow-on to that answer. So the state, when they made this commitment to go to value-based payment through the district program, which was the primary, the hospital and doctor program, they convened a number of work groups over a two-year period. It was an extensive process. It wrapped up about 18 months ago. But they had these work groups called clinical advisory groups, CAGs, great acronym, CAGs. But there was a behavioral health CAG, and they came up, I believe, with like 63 quality metrics that they would then propose to the managed care organizations to then work out with the provider community. So the short answer to your question is we don't know. Well, we know that we will hear what is going to get paid for from the managed care organizations that we contract with. We don't know what those are yet, but we know what the pool of potential metrics is. And Bob mentioned PSYCHES. That's an Office of Mental Health database where they're already collecting some data based on claims. And what we're doing is we within our own BHCC, soon to be IPA, we're identifying those that seem to make the most sense for a rural community that has the kind of nature and culture that we have here in the North Country. And we're going to select, I think, 6 to 12 of these, and we're going to begin, using the PSYCHES database, we're going to begin monitoring our own members and then reporting out to them how they're doing in comparison to the state and how they're doing in comparison to each other. And that is the way the system will work over time. And, you know, we will be sending in our report cards to the managed care organizations, and they're going to compare us to their benchmarks and to the state benchmarks. And that potential for shared savings and bonus money will come based on how we do, how our report card is compared to those metrics. Sir?
Who determines the budget? Is the budget based upon an individual patient's diagnosis and comorbidity? Who establishes the pie that is going to be divided among providers and above among providers' organizations, such as yours?
Yeah, so essentially the insurance companies will contract with an organization like the ACO to set a budget for that population. And that population will be based upon the risk, and that is determined by the comorbidities they have, any other social determinants that factor into that population. And so they'll come up with that total budget, and that's where the number's set. So they'll also have a percentage where they'll say if you save this much, then you start being eligible for the shared savings.
So, again, let me just follow on. So let's say it looks quite likely that we will go in with the Adirondacks ACO, which is part of affiliated with the whole Vermont health system. They're very sophisticated. So we will be responsible for doing the behavioral health piece. They're going to do the physical health hospital services. So if we get in that scenario where we do get into shared savings and there is X number of dollars on the table that have to be distributed, so ultimately that's going to go to the ACO. And we don't have the answer to this yet. Is, you know, we have to define what our contribution as behavioral health care providers is to that saving, that pot of saved money. So we have to be able to go forward to them and say, we can document based on, you know, our data analytics that of the $100 that was saved, behavioral health
you know, is responsible for $25 of that.
So
and then we have to develop that methodology. It has not been done yet, as far as I know.
So for instance, one of the things that would probably be looked at is if a patient has a history of presenting at the emergency department frequently or inpatient admissions very frequently, and what the medical community is learning is that behavioral health and substance abuse are extremely important comorbidities in terms of that, and somebody with at least one medical and at least one behavioral health condition, the cost is two to three times more than somebody with a medical condition alone. So being able to demonstrate that within this population or this set of patients that we can have this impact on that utilization and driving down those high cost utilization, there's where the opportunity is to set the value for the BNCC and the IPA.
You said that the likelihood is that a pool of money will be given to manage behavioral health. Is that what you said?
Not necessarily. The pool of money, basically, like I said, the budget for that population will be identified in the contract between the ACO and the managed care organization.
What happens with entities that cherry pick, take easier patients, therefore having better outcomes? How do you factor that in?
So that's a big difference from the old managed care days, where it was just a set number per patient. These typically are risk adjusted, so they're looking at what is the patient's what comorbidities do they have, what is their level of disease or whatever they, and then that way they say if somebody is a higher cost patient, the budget for them is higher. If somebody's a lower cost patient, the budget for them is lower. So that there's less incentive for a provider to say. And in fact, in a lot of ways, there's more incentive for a provider to take on a higher cost patient if they see that as an opportunity to reduce the cost for that patient. Somebody like end-stage renal disease or something, that may not be the case, but somebody who's simply a high utilizer, that we can do some, we can introduce some programs to bring that utilization down, then there's actually a better opportunity high-cost patient.
In the long run, when we get into more of a per-member, per-month type of situation where providers are going to, the ACO is going to be provided kind of a global global amount per patient, the vision is, and again, the vision and what becomes reality for, you know, three to 5 years from now, we have, you know, we'll see. But the vision is that a lot of the regulations that restrict what Medicaid can do will be loosened. And the true care decisions will really be driven not from the state or from the managed care organization, but right down to the local level. And so the care managers, if really what a person needs is a Uber to the drugstore, because they don't have any way to get there to pick up their meds, that kind of flexibility, you know, would be available. And you can think of lots of things. Maybe it's Meals on Wheels. Maybe it's getting a person to a psychosocial club that they have not had access to. So there's the vision here is that we want to do what is least expensive and most effective. That's where this needs to go. And the state realizes that by liberalizing the Medicaid rules and regulations and giving care managers some flexibility, that level of creativity can be developed. And it's already happening. The home and community-based service program is moving in that direction. The self-directed care program for folks with physical disabilities is already happening, where family members, rather than, you know, paying an expensive caregiver, and there's a tremendous staffing shortage for home care providers, it's well documented, is beginning to look at who else in the community could possibly pick up some of this care with proper oversight
and be reimbursed at a somewhat lower level, but be reimbursed for something that, you know, often is you know, goes unreimbursed and unrecognized. So the idea is to make things more flexible, drive the decision making right down to the local level, but with the data collection systems in place to allow us to measure this. So it's not going to be the wild, wild west. We're not just going to be throwing money out on the street for grabs. This will all be tied to sophisticated data collection and analytics. And we believe that at this point in the game, the lion's share of the $1.725 million that was awarded to citizen advocates will go to support the 15 agencies implementing and really getting up to speed with their data, their ability to collect and measure and report out on data. So that's what we think that the, you know, a lion's share of this money is going to go towards.
And again, that's an important point. If you go back to slide 2, in the MCO model, you had the prior authorization and utilization. In a level 2 or a level 3 value-based payment model, that pretty much goes away. The insurance company is not the one calling the shots on what care is appropriate. It's the providers. And just to build a little bit more on what Barry said, there was a program at CBPH where they were looking at the high utilizers of the emergency room. The person that was the highest was basically, even though they had a medical condition and every time they came in, all the assessments were about the medical condition, it was really anxiety that was driving that. And the person was having trouble keeping up with things around their house. They sent people out to mow the lawn, sent people out to help him organize his house. His utilization didn't completely disappear, but it fell off a cliff. There's people, you know, buying air conditioners, getting apartments fumigated for bed bugs and things like that, that just have an unbelievable impact on this very, very high cost utilization. So again, their organization, whether it is directly or indirectly, would be contracting with the payers on essentially a per member per month. Right. And so whatever services they deliver to that patient, they're paying for out of that PMPM. Now, it gets more complicated when you have a model that we discussed where it's contracting with, instead of directly with the MCO, with an ACO, accountable care organization, or something like that. There's that all still needs to get defined.
For the foreseeable future, we will start in an upside-only relationship through the ACO, behavioral health will. We do believe we will eventually move to this level 2. They're going to want us to do upside-downside. But again, that contract, the upside-downside, is going to be between the ACO and the managed care organizations. Then they, in turn, will turn around with the provider community, and they may continue to do fee-for-service really indefinitely, but with quality metrics. So you'll get your fee-for-service providing you are meeting the quality access and cost metrics.
So you see the tier 2 people involved.
And then we got a couple of different tiers here. So tier 2 membership.
Okay, membership. I think tier 2 providers will they move away from fee-for-service?
They may or may not. As Barry said, that could play out a couple different ways. In particular, the smaller ones, they may be still doing something approaching a fee-for-service, but it would be directly with that accountable care organization through the BHCC or the IPA for specific people where they think they can have that impact.
What does it do to patient choice? Patient choice.
As far as I can tell, we haven't seen where this would impact people that are getting services from their current providers, will still continue. There's no incentive to have people switch. I don't think there'll be an impact on patient choice. So they should be able to continue to go to their existing providers. Now, in St. Lawrence County, there is a bit of a unique situation. St. Lawrence County gets pulled by two different gravitational fields. They get pulled by Jefferson County, and they get pulled by the whole eastern Adirondack region. So you have several different hospital systems here. So depending upon the contracts that those hospital systems and their affiliated doctors have, that could impact access where patients may have to say, okay, I have to go with this health system and pretty much get all my services through that health system. The North Country Initiative out of Fort Drum Regional Health Planning Organization is the group that's really doing the same kind of work down in what they're calling the Tug Hill region, so Jefferson, Lewis, St. Lawrence County, and then the Eastern Adirondack group is doing that. So I won't say there is no potential that folks may have to, kind of declare their allegiance to which hospital system they're going to go to. I think that's going to happen everywhere in the state as these groups of providers are coming together to try and create a critical mass of patients to be able to spread risk out. There will be, various systems set up as we move forward. So there will be choice, but if your doctor is affiliated with one health system and your behavioral health provider is with another health system, there may be some issues there because the way it works is if you go out of network, so if the patient is assigned to one network. And they go out of network. The way it's currently set up, the home network has to pay the other network if the person migrates out, and so there's going to be a huge incentive to keep people in their own network. But the way the rules are written right now, a person can go wherever they want, and this becomes like a big issue with people that like go to Florida in the wintertime. It's like they're getting all their services out of network, and that's driving New York State nuts. But anyway, that's how it is.
It's hard to comprehend how all these additional layers, these acronyms you talk about, are cost savings in the long run. And I guess, in my mind, I wonder what's the difference between this layer of bureaucracy and what insurance companies do. They siphon off a part of the money that goes to healthcare. And I not that you're responsible for it, but it's certainly a concern.
Except it doesn't. New York State has already, by implementing on the physical health side, by implementing managed care and value-based payment, moving in that direction on the physical health side, has already earned itself $10 billion in reinvestment from the federal government. That is how the whole DSRIP program was funded. It was money that was New York State saved by moving into a Medicaid managed care environment. So we know it works if it's done well. What we don't know is how well it works with behavioral health care. So this, we're the last folks to the party. So before Medicaid did it, Medicare did it. The Medicare Medical Home Project, which has been done throughout the state, also incentivized doctors through and had all these same layers, but incentivized physicians and hospitals to really look at their quality and strive to improve access, quality, and the experience of care for their patients, and they save money by doing that. So it. Like, on the face of it, doesn't make any sense. Why are you adding all these different layers? But if these layers are working and doing what they're supposed to do, the system saves money, and in the case of Medicaid, it's flattening out that growth curve. So, and of course, that's important to counties because, unlike most states, the counties pick up a piece of the bill in New York State. Do you serve on a hospital board?
No.
You ask great questions. You should. You should. Yeah. Ask great questions. Anything else? Jay, anything else?
Come in as a tier two provider, and at some point, if you want to transition to tier one, you have that.
You can move from tier one to tier two within the IPA, and that's in the document that we're creating now. Thank you very much, folks, and welcome to Health Economics 101. You've all passed with great grades. Mr. Burke, really, if you get a chance to serve on a hospital board, you do great questions.
All right, moving along with the resolutions we have from Community Services. We need a motion modifying the 2018 Community Services budget for the Delivery System Reform Incentive Payment Program Clinic. Need a motion, Mr. Perkins, seconded by Mr. Timmerman.
All right, so this kind of actually ties in to Barry's and Bob's conversation, because this is the DSRIP, which is the Incentive Reinvestment Incentive Program that we've been a part of now for 2 years. And today, the nurse practitioner finally saw the first patients in the public health clinic. So this money is, this resolution is to move, is to increase our revenue based on those services so that we can pay for the salary expense of having the nurse practitioner provide those services.
Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Next one, we need a motion for authorization to create and fill a licensed practical nurse position in the Community Services Department. Mr. Sherman, and seconded by Mr. Hooper.
All right. What I'm asking for here is a licensed practical nurse. It kind of dovetails into one of last month's resolution in which we tried to level the salary bases amongst the providers and at the same time provide kind of an incentive-based pay program. And currently what is happening is that our providers are doing a lot of additional, you know, responsibilities that typically in other medical facilities would be done by nursing staff. So some of those, you know, would be, you know, taking the vital signs, obtaining weight and BMI, filling out pre-authorizations for medication, obtaining I-STOPS, which is if someone takes controlled substances, it's a database where you have to go in and look to make sure that they're not getting the same controlled substances from other providers, i.e. doctor shopping. So, you know, it's kind of it's a stopgap to keep people from abusing controlled substances. Organizing and obtaining the lab results, taking calls from pharmacies, fielding patient calls, doing an Ames test, which is like an involuntary movement scale test for people who are on antipsychotic medication. So all these services typically right now are being done by our medical providers, and it's taking away their time. So they're not as likely to see as many patients if they continue to do those responsibilities. So in the instance of a PA, like right now our PA is seeing 5.4 patients a day on average, our physician assistant. If we were to move her to where she sees 8 people a day, that would be a net county benefit of $27,367. Likewise, if we are able, and the nurse practitioner is currently about the same level of production. So if we were to move her to 8 patients a day, that would increase the county revenues by $36,720. So it'll be a net increase of revenue of $64,087. And then likewise, if we were to move them to seeing 9 patients a day, that would have an increase of revenue of $81,727. And additionally, because of the DSRIP, we would also be able to use this person in that clinic if, in fact, one of the other nurses are not available to be in the DSRIP clinic during the Monday clinic.
Yes, Mr. Forsyth.
Isn't that kind of going against what we just listened to? We're wanting to increase productivity, but we have to maintain good results, you know?
I'm not following you.
Well, here we're talking, right now they're doing 5, the quality. How's the quality? Are we going to maintain the same quality at 9 as with 5?
Some of our prescribers are spending, hours on the phone, with pharmacies and doing pre-authorizations and things like that.
They could be focusing on...
They could be focused more on patient care rather than doing these ancillary services.
So this basically just free them up to give them access to do it. Okay.
Mr. Burke.
Jay, in a couple months' time, or 3 months' time, will you be able to do a cost-benefit analysis for all 3 of those positions?
We're following it fairly closely right now in terms of, units of service and so forth.
Well, we're
but you mean based on the figures that I've reported to you tonight?
Well, now adding in the LPN, that increased the cost of delivering care to each of our patients. So the question is that we have a PA, we have a nurse practitioner. Now that we've added an LPN to that, or may add an LPN to that mix, will we have some sort of analysis in 2 or 3 months to show that that was a good move and that it actually paid the county to do that, and that the salaries involved with all 3 are approaching what they're bringing in as far as revenue?
Yes, yeah, we can do that.
Mr. Perkins.
Jay, the production units right now, you said around 5 for the medical providers. What's to assure that if we bring this licensed practice nurse in, that the production numbers are going to increase?
Well, I mean, it's just based on the amount of time that they're currently spending on doing these tasks, if we could free them up from having to do that, and we could put, in a 2-hour time, you can put 2 to 3 more people in the schedules. If they're spending 2 hours a day, up to 2 hours a day doing these services, then...
If I may, are we turning people away now, or is there a waiting list preventing them from seeing them now, or is it just time management on them, or...?
In terms of the providers, we don't keep a waiting list for the medical providers. If anything, we have to schedule out further for first-time appointments, and we're not doing that badly right now. We have developed a waiting list for first-time therapy appointments, though.
So how far are we scheduling out? Week, 2 weeks?
Well, I haven't looked at it this week, but, right now, because we just brought on the nurse practitioner, she's still building her caseload, but also at the same time is bringing quite a few people with her from her prior place of employment. So it's really it's hard to know, how this is all going to level out when she's fully established. So prior to her coming on board, we were scheduling sometimes 30 to 45 days out for a prescriber.
Anybody else? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? One no.
Motion carries. Next one, we need a motion authorizing the chair to sign a lead service and limitation on liability agreement with the North Country Initiative, LLC. Mr. Burke, seconded by Mr. Perkins.
This is an agreement that we're asking the chair to sign. It's been reviewed by the county attorney. And again, it's NCI's North Country Initiative, which is the PPS, that is kind of has kind of brokered the DSRIP monies. And they, you know, want this agreement signed so that, for the most part, they're held harmless for any of the services that we expand into based on using the DSRIP monies, that they're not responsible for any occurrences that you know that would hold them liable for the use of those monies and distribution of the funds that they've already have and will continue to distribute to the county.
Any questions on that? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Jay. For Department of Social Services, we need a motion for authorization to fill a social welfare examiner position in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Denisha and Mr. Timmerman.
This first proposed position is a position that's being vacated by a long-term employee who's retiring on July 30th, so the position is currently occupied. Due to the high volume of work, we're asking for a 30-day fill from the date vacated, and this position is reimbursed at approximately 67.5%.
Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Next one, we need a motion for authorization to fill a social welfare examiner position in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Perkins, seconded by Mr. Arquette.
This position was vacated on June 29th due to a promotion. It's the same position as the previous one. Because of the high volume of work, we are also asking for a 30-day fill, and this position is again reimbursed at 67.5%.
Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Next one, we need a motion for authorization to fill two temporary social welfare examiner positions in the Department of Social Services in the HEAP program. Mr. Denisha and Ms. Bell.
So these two social welfare examiner positions are utilized in the busiest part of the HEAP season and are paid at the trainee grade. These are temporary seasonal positions and are only utilized for the hours that are needed. These positions are not eligible for paid time off. Last year we had very strong numbers for the HEAP benefit, and we also had a second emergency benefit as well. And these positions are reimbursed at approximately 72%.
Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Next one. Need a motion for authorization to fill a temporary clerk position in the Department of Social Services in the HEAP program. Mr. Perkins, seconded by Mr. Arquette.
Due to the high volume of work, this clerk position is essential to respond to applicants and to ensure that the timely processing of applications occurs during our busy HEAP season. This proposed position is reimbursed at approximately 72% as well.
Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Next one is a motion for authorization to fill a case supervisor grade B position in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Perkins, seconded by Mr. Burke.
This proposed position is vacant due to a promotion. This person would oversee the training and certifying of foster parents, case management, and support to children who are placed with relatives, and also children who are transitioning to adoption. This position is reimbursed at approximately 71.7%.
Any questions? All in favor? Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one is we need a motion for authorization to fill a caseworker position in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Perkins, seconded by Mr. Burke again.
This proposed position is a caseworker position in the Children's Services Adolescent Unit. It was vacated on 6/15 due to a promotion and also reimbursed at approximately 71.7%.
Any questions? Yes. Go ahead, Mr. Frosty.
These reimbursements, are they staying the same over time? Have they fluctuated or are they going down?
Well, it is.
These all seem a little bit lower.
It is an approximation, and they do fluctuate slightly, but I'm not aware, at least in the past few years, that they've fluctuated.
Or gone down
very
drastically.
Much, no. I'm not aware of that. This is a pretty standard percentage for child welfare,
okay.
Be it CPS or preventive.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one is we need a motion for authorization to fill a caseworker / CPS position in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Denisha, seconded by Mr. Burke.
This proposed position is a caseworker position in CPS. It was vacated on June 29th due to a resignation. Currently, our average caseload size is 34, and this position has the same reimbursement, approximately 71.7%.
Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Next one, we need a motion for authorization to create and fill a temporary senior account clerk position in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Perkins or Mr. Burke?
This proposed position would be a temporary position that the commissioner has discussed previously. The unit is lean at the moment, and we anticipate losing two senior account clerks by the end of the year. This position, if it is approved, would turn into a permanent position when one of those senior account clerks retire. And this position is even more important now as we will soon lose our fiscal manager as well.
Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one is we need a motion for authorization to abolish a community services worker position and create and fill a caseworker assistant position in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Burke and Mr. Perkins.
So these next two positions are the result of strategic planning. We're not proposing to change the number of employees. Both of these are abolish and create. Child Protective Services caseworkers and our secretary are in desperate need of assistance. And these positions would be reimbursed with the same reimbursement as our other child welfare positions, 71.7%.
Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one, we need a motion for authorization to abolish a social welfare examiner position and create and fill a caseworker position and a caseworker assistant position in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Burke and Mr. Perkins.
So as similar to what I mentioned before, the vacancy here is due to a retirement.
Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. And the last one, we need a motion for authorization to fill a fiscal manager position and authorizing the chair to sign a contract for training in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Hooper, seconded by Mr. Burke.
So this proposed position is our attempt to respond quickly to the upcoming vacancy that we have for our fiscal manager, effective 7/27. The proposal is asking for an immediate fill, and if it were approved today, we would ask to be able to send out canvas letters prior to full board approval. This position is responsible for an enormous portion of the county budget, as you all know, and the earlier that we can request the list and canvas, the better. The resolution also references the potential for a contractual agreement to pay the current fiscal manager for approximately 40 hours during the month of August to provide some training for her replacement. There's also two proposed revisions to this resolution under the last whereas, changing salary to rate, and also under be it further resolved, the last sentence, instead of upon approval of the agenda, upon approval of the county attorney. It was already made. Oh, I apologize. I printed it off this morning, so that was done.
Yes, Mr. Burke.
No.
Yeah, the changes have already been made. Yeah. Okay. They're already in the resolution. Yeah. Any questions for Heather on this? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Any older new business? Seeing none, county, oh no. Well, do you have stuff? Yeah,
yep. Also, okay. So carried over from the operations committee meeting, I'll go over my report for both committees now. I have two transfer of funds totaling $5,800 to report out to you. $800 was the appropriation for the board office phone charges that were additional over 2017. Also, the $5,000 that were that's been transferred was higher than expected. Fees associated with advertising for department head positions. Generally, we've not placed these any monies available in department level budgets without the expectation that they'll be needed. So we've paid for them out of the board office budget as well as legal notice announcements. To give you an update, though you've looked already tonight at 19 positions of the 21 that were reviewed at the vacancy committee, you have seen so far this year 101 positions. Next month I'll bring you the analysis like I did last August, capturing the 12-month review of those positions. But so far just this year, the immediate fills have been 50, 30-day waits are 21, and 60-day waits have been 19. There were two that were held and then later on considered differently than proposed. You'll see three additional positions at the Finance Committee meeting from Highway. One, to let you know, the annual picnic was held last Friday. Some of the legislators were able to attend. Andrea Montgomery did an outstanding job making sure that there were enough staff on hand and volunteers to make sure we moved through and had everyone fed. It was a warm day, but it was a great meal in an even better location, so we got to enjoy the Governor Community Center. We had requested, I believe it was at the June meeting, to have all of you dress for a photo to be taken for the proceedings. We'll now hold off until the temperatures cool and attempt to do that at the November Board of Legislators meeting. That will also be the longevity ceremony that evening. That's November 5th. Tomorrow, there will be four of us with approval to travel to Albany for three initiatives to meet with staff from the governor's office. That will include the land claim, the internet sales tax initiative, and raise the age. So the chairman, the vice chairman, the county attorney, and I will be traveling all day tomorrow. On Wednesday, the new director for the Fort Drum Regional Liaison Organization, Fritz Keel, will be coming up. He's making the rounds to meet all the board members and those associated with FDRLO. The Veterans Services Director, Mike Beaupre, will join us, as well as board member Joe Lightfoot. Certainly, we hope to educate him on St. Lawrence County and to understand from him what his plans are for the organization. We received a request from Ogdensburg, the city of Ogdensburg, for a CFA application they'll be preparing for their wastewater treatment plant. Provided there's no objection, I'll prepare one from the district legislator, the chairman, and from the county under my signature that would support them for $4.6 million as the primary disposal for their neighboring communities, as well as a backup for the other communities who already have a primary location designated. On Friday, the DEC will be hosting an event to celebrate their takeover of the JNL cleanup efforts. Larry, as the district legislator, and Kevin as chairman, will have agreed to speak, and that will take place at 1 o'clock at Clifton Fine High School. So if any of you would like to join us, we can make travel arrangements for you. On Tuesday, spoke about it when Mary Lou was present this evening, the Governor Department of Motor Vehicles site will be holding a ribbon cutting for their third terminal. That was a demonstration of a great partnership with the town, who was able to prepare all of the efforts necessary and the materials for that terminal. On last Friday, I met with Don Peck at the fairgrounds to prepare for the Finance Committee meeting, moved to July 30th. And he will be hosting you on the grandstand. We'll provide directions to you. They're going to make arrangements so that you'll drive right up to the back of the grandstand and enter from the rear of the grandstand to be able to get right to your seats. We will attempt to keep the agenda light and will not plan to have an executive session unless one is absolutely necessary. And the fair opens the next day. So they'll also be able to amplify the meeting and you'll be able to hear all through Governor.
So very excited to host the legislative body at the fair this year. And I believe that's all I have, unless there's questions.
Is there any questions for Ruth on any of that? Okay, thank you, Ruth. I guess we are now to executive session, correct? Yes. Do we have a need? We have a need for executive session for negotiations, litigation, personnel, and appointments. Can I have a motion? So moved, seconded by Mr. Timmerman. We are now in executive session.